Antiquities Book 10. 1. The campaign of the Assyrian king Sennacherib against Jerusalem and his siege of Hezekiah, their king. 2. How the Assyrian army was destroyed by plague in a single night, and their king, after withdrawing home, was killed in a plot by his own sons. 3. How Hezekiah lived out the rest of his life in peace and died, leaving Manasseh as his successor to the kingdom. 4. That the kings of the Chaldeans and Babylonians campaigned against him, defeated him, took him captive, and led him to Babylon, and after holding him there a long time, released him again to the same kingdom. 5. How, when the Egyptian king Necho campaigned against the Babylonians and made his way through Judea, King Josiah went out to stop him. A battle took place, and Josiah, carried wounded to Jerusalem, died, and the people of Jerusalem made his son Jehoahaz king. 6. How Necho, after engaging the king of the Babylonians at the Euphrates River and turning back toward Egypt, came to Jerusalem, took Jehoahaz away to Egypt, and made his brother Jehoiakim king of the Jerusalemites. 7. The campaign of Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Babylonians, into Syria, and how, after subduing all of it as far as the borders of Egypt, he went up to Jerusalem and forced their king Jehoiakim to become his friend and ally. 8. How, after the Babylonians' withdrawal, Jehoiakim again inclined toward the Egyptians, and Nebuchadnezzar campaigned against him and besieged the city. When it surrendered after a time, he killed Jehoiakim and set up his son Jehoiachin as king. 9. That Nebuchadnezzar, regretting having made Jehoiachin king, campaigned against Jerusalem and gained control of Jehoiachin, who surrendered himself along with his mother and his friends. How the Babylonian took many captives, carried off the temple treasures, and returned to Babylon, setting up Jehoiachin's uncle Zedekiah as king of the people of Jerusalem. 10. How, hearing that this man too wished to make an alliance and friendship with the Egyptians, he campaigned against Jerusalem, took it by force in the siege, burned the temple, deported the people of Jerusalem, and removed Zedekiah to Babylon. 11. How Nebuchadnezzar, on dying, left his son as successor to the kingdom, and how their rule was ended by Cyrus, king of the Persians. 12. What happened to the Jews at this time among the Babylonians? This book covers a period of 182 years, 6 months, and 10 days. Hezekiah, king of the two tribes, was already in the 14th year of his reign when the king of the Assyrians, called Sennacherib, campaigned against him with great preparation, and took by force all the cities of the tribe of Judah and of Benjamin. When he was about to lead his forces against Jerusalem as well, Hezekiah forestalled him by sending envoys, promising to obey him and to pay whatever tribute he might set. Learning this from the envoys, Sennacherib decided not to make war, but accepted the request. On receiving 300 talents of silver and 30 of gold, he agreed to withdraw as a friend, giving the envoys sworn pledges that, having suffered no wrong, he would return on these terms. Hezekiah, persuaded, emptied his treasuries and sent the money, thinking he would be freed from the war and from the struggle over his kingdom. But the Assyrian, once he had received it, paid no regard whatever to what he had promised. Instead, he himself campaigned against the Egyptians and the Ethiopians, but left his general Rabsakes, together with two other officials of rank, with a large force to ravage Jerusalem. Their names were Thiratha and Arrakaris. When they arrived and encamped before the walls, they sent to Hezekiah demanding that he come out to a parley. He himself, out of fear, did not go out, but sent three of his closest friends, Eliakim, the steward of the kingdom, Shebna, and Joe, the recorder. These went forward and stood opposite the commanders of the Assyrian army. When the general Rabsakes saw them, he ordered them to go back and tell Hezekiah that the great king Sennacherib wanted to know in what he trusted and relied, that he fled from his master, refused to listen, and would not receive his army into the city, or whether, hoping in the Egyptians, he expected his own army to prevail through them. If that is what he expects, let him be told that he is a fool, like a man who leans on a broken reed, which not only falls but pierces his hand as it falls, so that he feels the injury. Let him know, too, that it is by the will of God that he has made this campaign against him, the God who gave him the kingdom of the Israelites to overthrow as well, so that in the same way he might destroy those under his rule. Rabsakes said this in Hebrew, for he was skilled in that tongue, and Eliakim, fearing that the crowd, on hearing it, would fall into confusion, asked him to speak in Aramaic. But the general, understanding his suspicion and the fear behind it, answered in a louder and more piercing voice, speaking in Hebrew all the same, so that on hearing the king's commands, all might choose what was to their advantage and surrender themselves to us. It is clear that you and the king are deceiving the people with empty hopes and persuading them to resist. If you are confident and think you can drive back our forces, I am ready to provide you 2,000 horses from those I have here. Give them riders in equal number, and so display your own strength, though you could not even furnish as many as that, since you do not have them. Why then do you delay handing yourselves over to those who are stronger, and who will take you whether you wish it or not? Yet voluntary surrender is safe for you, while resistance, if you go on fighting against your will prove dangerous and the cause of disasters. Hearing this, the people and the envoys reported to Hezekiah what the Assyrian general had said. In response, he took off his royal robe, put on sackcloth, and assumed a posture of humility. And following ancestral custom, falling on his face, he implored God and begged him to help one who had no other hope of safety. He also sent some of his friends and some of the priests to the prophet Isaiah, asking him to entreat God and, after offering sacrifices for the common safety, to call on him to be indignant at the enemy's hopes and to have mercy on his people. The prophet did this, and when God had given him an oracle, he encouraged the king himself and the friends around him, foretelling that the enemy would be defeated without a battle and would withdraw in disgrace, not with the boldness they now displayed. For God was providing for their destruction. He also foretold that Sennacherib himself, king of the Assyrians, would fail in his design against Egypt, and that on returning home he would perish by the sword. It happened that at this same time, the Assyrian had also written letters to Hezekiah, in which he called him foolish for supposing that he would escape the servitude he imposed, when he had subdued many great and powerful nations, and he threatened to destroy him utterly if he did not willingly open his gates and receive his army into Jerusalem. On reading this, Hezekiah despised it because of his trust in God, and folding up the letters, he laid them up inside the temple. And when he had again offered his prayers to God concerning the city and the safety of all, the prophet Isaiah declared that he had been heard, and that for the present the city would not be besieged by the Syrian, that the people would farm in peace, unafraid of anything he had done, and tend their own property without any fear. A little time later, the king of the Assyrians, having failed in his design against the Egyptians, withdrew home without success, for the following reason. He had spent much time on the siege of Pelusium, and when the mounds he had raised against the walls were already high and he was on the point of assaulting them, he heard that the king of the Ethiopians, Tharsakes, was coming with a large force to aid the Egyptians, having resolved to march through the desert and fall suddenly upon the Assyrians. Thrown into confusion by this news, King Sennacherib is said to have campaigned against the priest of Hephaestus. Since this king had gone against the king of the Egyptians, who was a priest of Hephaestus, and while besieging Pelusium, he broke off the siege for the following reason. The king of the Egyptians prayed to his god, who, hearing him, sent a plague upon the Arab. Here too Herodotus errs, calling the king not of the Assyrians, but of the Arabians, for he says that a multitude of mice gnawed through the bows and the rest of the weapons of the Assyrians in a single night, and that for this reason, having no bows, the king withdrew his army from Pelusium. This is Herodotus's account. But Berossus, who wrote the history of the Chaldeans, also mentions King Sennacherib, both that he ruled the Assyrians and that he campaigned against all Asia and Egypt, speaking as follows. When Sennacherib returned from the wars against the Egyptians to Jerusalem, he found there the force under his general Rhapsakes, upon which God had sent a plague. On the very first night of the siege, 185,000 men perished, together with their commanders and officers. Thrown into fear and terrible anguish by this disaster, and fearing for the whole of his remaining army, he fled with the rest of his forces to his own kingdom, called Nineveh. After spending a short time there, he was treacherously murdered by his elder sons Adramelech and Sharezer, and died, and was laid to rest in his own temple, called Aresk. Those who fled after the murder of their father because of the citizens went off to Armenia, and Esarhaddon, who held Sennacherib in contempt, succeeded to the kingdom after them. Such, then, was the end that befell the Assyrian campaign against the people of Jerusalem. King Hezekiah, unexpectedly freed from his fears, offered thanksgiving sacrifices to God together with all the people, since it was by no other cause that the enemy had perished, some destroyed outright, others driven away from Jerusalem by fear of a like death, than by the alliance of God. Yet though he showed every zeal and devotion toward God, not long after he fell into a grave illness, and was given up by the physicians, who expected nothing good for him, nor did his friends. To his illness was added a terrible despondency, since the king reckoned that he was childless, and that he would die leaving his house and his rule without a legitimate successor. Suffering above all from this thought, and lamenting, he implored God to grant him a little further span of life, until he should father children, and not to let his soul depart before he became a father. God took pity on him and accepted his request, since it was not because he was about to be deprived of the good things of his kingdom that he lamented his supposed death, nor because he had begged for more time to live for its own sake, but because he wanted children to succeed to his rule. And he sent the prophet Isaiah to tell him that he would recover from his illness after the third day and would live 15 years beyond it, and that children would be born to him. When the prophet, by God's command, announced this, Hezekiah, because of the severity of his illness and the strangeness of what was reported, did not believe it, and asked Isaiah for some sign, some marvel, so that he might believe he spoke these things as one come from God. For what is beyond reckoning and greater than hope is confirmed to men by like extraordinary events. When Isaiah asked him what sign he wished to have happen, he asked that the sun, since it had already made the shadow decline 10 steps in the house, be made to turn back to the same place again. When the prophet called on God to display this sign to the king, Hezekiah saw what he wanted, and at once, freed from his illness, went up to the temple, and having bowed before God, offered his prayers. At this same time, it happened that the empire of the Assyrians was overthrown by the Medes. I will explain this elsewhere. The king of the Babylonians, whose name was Baladan, sent envoys to Hezekiah bearing gifts, and urged him to become his ally and friend. Hezekiah gladly received the envoys, entertained them, and showed them his treasuries, his store of weapons, and all the rest of his wealth, however much he possessed in precious stones and gold. And after giving them gifts to carry back to Baladan, he sent them home. When the prophet Isaiah came to him and asked where these visitors had come from, he said they had come from Babylon, sent by God, and that he had shown them everything, so that, seeing his wealth and power, they might form a judgment from it and report accordingly to their king. The prophet, taking this up, said, "Know that not long from now this wealth of yours will be carried off to Babylon, and your descendants will be made eunuchs, and having lost their manhood, will serve as slaves to the king of Babylon, for this is what God foretells." Hezekiah, grieved at what had been said, replied that he would not wish such disasters to befall his nation, but since it was not possible to alter what God had decreed, he prayed that peace might prevail for the rest of his own life. Berossus 2 mentions Baladan, king of the Babylonians. This prophet was, by common consent, divine and marvelous in his truthfulness. Trusting that he had never spoken anything false, he set down in writing everything he had prophesied and left it behind, to be recognized by later generations from its fulfillment. And not this prophet alone, but 12 others as well did the same, and whatever misfortune. But we will report each of these prophecies later, one by one. Hezekiah lived out the time we have mentioned, passing the whole of it in peace, and died at the age of 54, having reigned 29 years. His son Manasseh succeeded to the kingdom. His mother, a native woman, was named Echiba. Manasseh broke completely with his father's practices and turned to the opposite course, displaying every kind of wickedness in his conduct and omitting no form of impiety, but imitating the transgressions of the Israelites, who had perished for their sins against God. He even dared to defile the temple of God, and the city, and the whole land. Starting from his contempt for God, he set out to kill all the righteous men among the Hebrews, and he spared not even the prophets. Some of these he slaughtered daily, so that Jerusalem ran with blood. God, angered by this, sent prophets to the king and to the people, through whom he threatened them with the same disasters that had befallen their Israelite brothers when they insulted him. They did not believe the words, though by them they could have gained escape from every evil, but by the deeds they learned that what the prophet said was true. For when they persisted in the same course, God stirred up war against them from the king of the Babylonians and Chaldeans, who sent an army into Judea and ravaged their land, and took King Manasseh by treachery, brought him before himself, and held him captive to inflict whatever punishment he wished. Manasseh, now understanding the evils he was in and considering himself the cause of them all, begged God to make his enemy kind and merciful toward him. God, hearing his supplication, granted him this, and Manasseh, released by the king of the Babylonians, was restored safely to his own land. Once back in Jerusalem, he was eager, so far as it was possible, to cast out from his soul even the memory of his former sins against God, which he had set himself to commit, and he practiced every form of piety toward him. He purified the temple, cleansed the city, and thereafter cared for one thing alone, to render thanks to God for his deliverance and to keep him well disposed toward him for the rest of his life. He also taught the people to do the same, having learned by his own narrow escape what disaster the opposite course brings. He repaired the altar and performed the customary sacrifices, as Moses had ordained. Having set in order the affairs of worship in the manner required, he also took care for the security of Jerusalem, repairing the old walls with great effort and adding another wall to them, raising very high towers, and making the fortresses before the city, together with all the supplies useful for them, including provisions of every kind, stronger than before. Indeed, so thoroughly did he reform himself in these respects that he passed the remainder of his life in such a way as to be counted blessed and enviable, reckoning his happiness from the time he began to worship God. He lived 67 years in all and ended his life, having reigned 55 of them. He was buried in his own gardens, and the kingdom passed to his son Ammon, whose mother, named Amasalmi, was from the city of Jazabate. This man imitated the deeds his father had dared while young, and plotted against by his own servants, he died in his own house, having lived 24 years and reigned 2 of them. The people avenged him on his murderers, and they buried Ammon beside his father, and handed the kingdom over to his son Josiah, who was 8 years old. His mother was from the city of Boscath, and her name was Edes. Josiah was by nature outstanding and well disposed toward virtue, taking the practices of King David as the aim and standard for the whole conduct of his life. At the age of 12, he already displayed piety and justice. He taught the people wisdom and urged them to abandon the belief in idols, since they were not gods, and to worship the God of their fathers instead. Reviewing the deeds of his ancestors, he corrected wisely whatever had gone wrong, as one who, though young, was most capable of perceiving what was needed, while whatever he found rightly established he kept in place and imitated. All this he did by wisdom and by a natural gift of understanding, and also by following the counsel and tradition of his elders. For by adhering to the laws in matters concerning the order of the city and piety toward the divine, he restored the prosperity that, because of the lawlessness of earlier kings, had failed to appear and had in fact vanished. Going about the whole city and the entire land, the king cut down the sacred groves dedicated to foreign gods and demolished their altars, and whatever votive offering had been dedicated to them by his ancestors he tore down in contempt. In this way, he turned the people from devotion to these gods to the worship of God, offering at his altar the customary sacrifices and burnt offerings. He appointed certain judges and overseers to administer the affairs of each community, so that they should place justice above everything and guard it no less carefully than their own souls. Sending gold and silver throughout the whole land, he ordered those who were willing to bring contributions for the repair of the temple, each according to his wish and his means. When the money had been brought in, he put in charge of the care of the temple and the expenditure for it the governor of the city, Amasias, the scribe Saphas, the keeper of records Jodos, and the high priest Eliakias, who, without any delay or postponement, provided architects and everything else useful for the repair, and set to work at once. And the temple, thus repaired, made the king's piety plain for all to see. Now in the 18th year of his reign, he sent to Eliakias the high priest, ordering him to melt down whatever was surplus and make from it mixing bowls, libation vessels, and cups for the service. And further, whatever gold and silver there was in the treasuries, to bring it forward as well and spend it in the same way on such vessels. As Eliakias the high priest was bringing forward the gold, he came upon the sacred books of Moses lying in the temple, and taking them out, he gave them to the scribe Saphas. He, having read them, went to the king and reported that everything he had ordered done had been completed, and he also read the books aloud to him. Hearing them, the king tore his garments, and calling the high priest Eliakias and the scribe himself, along with some of his closest friends, he sent them to the prophetess Ulda, the wife of Salum, a woman of some standing and distinguished by her noble birth, instructing them, once they had come before her, to say, "Propitiate God and try to make him favorable to us, for there is fear that, since our ancestors transgressed the laws of Moses, we may be in danger of being uprooted and cast out of our own land into a foreign one, stripped of everything, end our lives in misery." Hearing this from those who had been sent, the prophetess answered, through those same men whom the king had commissioned, ordering them to go back and tell the king that God had already passed sentence against the people, a sentence that no supplication could annul. To destroy the people, cast them out of their land, and strip them of all the good things now theirs, because they had transgressed the laws and, over so long a time, had not repented, even though the prophets had urged them to come to their senses and had foretold the punishment for their impieties, a punishment which, so that they might be convinced that he is God and had lied about nothing of what he had announced to them through the prophets, he would certainly bring to pass. Yet for Josiah's own sake, since he had proved himself just, God would hold off the calamities for the present, and only after his death would he send upon the people the sufferings decreed against them. Those who had heard the woman's prophecy came and reported it to the king. He sent word everywhere ordering the people to gather at Jerusalem, both priests and Levites, commanding that everyone of every age be present. Once they had assembled, he first read to them the sacred books. Then, standing on the platform in the midst of the crowd, compelled them to swear oaths and give their word that they would indeed worship God and keep the laws of Moses. They eagerly assented and undertook to do what the king urged, sacrificing at once, and once the omens proved favorable, they begged God to be gracious and merciful to them. The king also ordered the high priest that any superfluous vessel which their ancestors had set up in the temple for idols and foreign gods should be thrown out. When a great many of these had been gathered together, he burned them and scattered their ashes, and he killed the priests of the idols who were not of the line of Aaron. Having accomplished this in Jerusalem, he went out into the countryside and destroyed what King Jeroboam had built there in honor of foreign gods, and he burned the bones of the false prophets upon the altar that Jeroboam had first built. A prophet had foretold this long before, coming down to Jeroboam while he was sacrificing, with the whole people listening, and announcing in advance what would happen, that someone of David's line named Josiah would do the things foretold. This came to pass 361 years later. After this, King Josiah went also to the rest of the Israelites who had escaped captivity and slavery under the Assyrians, and persuaded them to give up their impious practices and abandon the honors they paid to foreign gods, and instead to worship the ancestral and greatest God and to hold fast to him. He searched their houses, villages, and cities, in case anyone secretly kept any idols. And not only this, but he also removed the chariots devoted to worship that stood ready for the kings, which their ancestors had made, and whatever else of that kind there was, to which they bowed down as to a god. Having thus purified the whole land, he called the people together to Jerusalem, and there celebrated the feast of unleavened bread and the one called Passover. For the Passover he gave the people newborn kids and 20,000 lambs, and for burnt offerings 3,000 oxen. The chief priests too gave, for the Passover, 2,600 lambs to the priests, and their leaders gave 5,000 lambs and 500 oxen to the Levites. With such an abundant supply of sacrificial animals provided, they carried out the sacrifices according to the laws of Moses, with each of the priests instructing and assisting the crowds. And the reason no other festival like it had been held by the Hebrews, since the days of Samuel, The profit was that everything was carried out in accordance with the laws and with the ancient observance of ancestral custom. Josiah lived afterward in peace, in wealth, and in good repute among all, and ended his life in the following way. Necho, king of the Egyptians, raised an army and marched to the Euphrates to make war on the Medes and the Babylonians, who had overthrown the Assyrian Empire, for he desired to rule over Asia. When he reached the city of Mende, which lay within Josiah's kingdom, Josiah barred his way with an army, refusing to let him march through his own land on his campaign against the Medes. Necho sent a herald to him, saying that he was marching not against him, but toward the Euphrates, and urging him not to provoke him into fighting, when all he was doing was preventing him from proceeding where he had decided to go. But Josiah would not accept Necho's proposal. He stood firm in refusing him passage through his own land, driven to this, I think, by fate, so that Necho might find a pretext against him. For as Josiah was drawing up his forces and riding in a chariot from wing to wing, one of the Egyptians shot him with an arrow and put an end to his eagerness for battle. In great pain from the wound, he ordered the army recalled and returned to Jerusalem. There he died of the wound and was buried in the tombs of his fathers with great splendor, having lived 39 years and reigned 31 of them. Great mourning was held for him by the whole people for many days, in grief and dejection, and Jeremiah the prophet composed for him a mournful funeral ode, which survives even to this day. This prophet also left in writing predictions of the disasters to come upon the city, including the very capture that has now befallen us in our own time, and the fall of Babylon as well. Nor was he the only one to foretell these things to the people, so did the prophet Ezekiel, who was the first to leave behind two books written about these matters. Both men were priests by birth, but Jeremiah lived in Jerusalem from the 13th year of Josiah's reign until the city and the temple were destroyed. What happened, however, concerning this prophet, we will relate in its proper place. When Josiah died, as we have said, his son succeeded to the kingdom. His name was Jozos, and he had already reached his 23rd year. He reigned in Jerusalem. His mother was Amittael from the city of Tamin. He was impious and vile in character. The king of the Egyptians, returning from the battle, sent for Jozos to come to him at the city called Amatha in Syria, and when he came, bound him, and gave the kingdom to his elder half-brother, named Eliakim, changing his name to Joachim. On the land he imposed 100 talents of silver and 1 of gold. This sum Joachim paid in full, and he led Jozos away to Egypt. Jochez died there, having reigned 3 months and 10 days. Joachim's mother was named Zabuda, and she came from a city called Abamas. He was by nature unjust and wicked, neither pious toward God nor decent toward men. In the 4th year of his reign, a man named Nebuchadnezzar took over the kingdom of Babylon. At about the same time, Nebuchadnezzar marched up with a great force against the city of Carchemish, which lies on the Euphrates River, intending to make war on Necho, king of the Egyptians, for all Syria was under Necho's control. When Necho learned of the Babylonians' intentions and of the campaign being mounted against him, he too did not hold back, but set out for the Euphrates with a large force to defend himself against Nebuchadnezzar. In the battle that followed, Necho was defeated and lost many tens of thousands of men. Nebuchadnezzar then crossed the Euphrates and took over Syria as far as Pelusium, with the exception of Judea. When Nebuchadnezzar had already reigned 4 years, it was the 8th year of Joachim's rule over the Hebrews, and the Babylonian marched against the Jews with a large force, demanding tribute from Joachim and threatening war if he refused. Joachim, fearing the threat, bought peace at the price of money, bringing him the tribute assessed for 3 years. In the 3rd year, hearing that the Egyptians were marching against the Babylonian, he withheld the tribute, but his hope was disappointed, for the Egyptians did not dare undertake the campaign. The prophet Jeremiah foretold these things day after day, warning that it was vain to place hope in the Egyptians, and that the city must be laid waste by the king of Babylon, and King Joachim delivered into his hands. But since none of those who might have been saved by heeding him existed, his words did no good. Both the people and the rulers, hearing them, disregarded them and took offense at what he said, charging Jeremiah with prophesying evil against the king, as though he were a bird diviner working against him. And bringing him to trial, they sought his condemnation and punishment. All the others cast their votes against him, condemning him along with the elders, but those of wiser judgment released the prophet from custody and advised the rest to do Jeremiah no harm. For, they said, he was not the only one who had foretold the city's future. Micah before him had proclaimed the same things, as had many others, none of whom had suffered anything at the hands of the kings of that time, but were rather honored as prophets of God. With these words, they calmed the crowd and rescued Jeremiah from the punishment that had been voted against him. Jeremiah then wrote down all his own prophecies, and while the people were fasting and assembled in the temple, in the 9th month of the 5th year of Jotham's reign, he read aloud the scroll he had composed concerning the things that were going to happen to the city, the temple, and the people. When the officials heard it, they took the scroll from him and ordered both him and his scribe Baruch to remove themselves from sight, so that they would not be found by anyone, and they themselves carried the scroll and gave it to the king. He, with his friends present, ordered his own scribe to take it and read it. But when the king heard what was in the scroll, he grew angry and tore it apart and threw it into the fire, destroying it, and he ordered that Jeremiah and his scribe Baruch be sought out and brought before him for punishment. These two, however, escaped his wrath. Not long afterward, the king of Babylon marched against him, receiving him without a fight, out of fear at what had been foretold by this prophet, and reckoning that he would suffer nothing terrible, he neither shut his gates nor made war. But once inside, the Babylonian did not keep faith. He put to death the strongest and most handsome of the Jerusalemites, along with King Jotham himself, whom he ordered to be thrown out unburied before the walls. He set up Jotham's son, also named Jotham, as king of the land and the city, and taking captive 3,000 of the men of rank, he led them away to Babylon. Among them was the prophet Ezekiel, still a boy. Such was the end that befell King Jotham, who lived 36 years and reigned 11 of them. His successor to the kingship, Jotham, whose mother was named Nehushta and was a native of the city, reigned 3 months and 10 days. But the king of Babylon, having just granted him the kingdom, was at once seized with fear. He feared that Jotham, remembering the killing of his father, might revolt against him, and so he sent a force and besieged Jotham in Jerusalem. Jotham, being by nature good and just, did not think it right to let the city be endangered on his account, but went out and surrendered himself, his mother, and his relatives to the general sent by the Babylonian, having first received oaths from them that neither they nor the city would suffer any harm. But that pledge did not even last a year. The king of Babylon did not keep it, but instructed his generals to take all the people in the city who were young in age and skilled craftsmen, bind them, and bring them to him. These numbered in all 18,332, along with Jotham himself, his mother, and his friends. These he brought to himself and kept under guard, and Jotham's uncle Zedekiah he appointed king, first taking an oath from him that he would truly keep the land for him, attempt no rebellion, and show no favor to the Egyptians. Zedekiah was 21 years old when he took the throne. He was Jotham's brother by the same mother, and he showed contempt for what was right and proper. Indeed, those around him, young in years, were impious, and the whole populace, given free rein, committed whatever outrages they pleased. For this reason, the prophet Jeremiah came to him often and admonished him, urging him to abandon his other impieties and lawless acts, to attend to justice, and neither to cling to the leaders because they were wicked among the people, nor to believe the false prophets who deceived him by claiming the Babylonian would no longer make war on the city, and that the Egyptians would march against him and win. These things, Jeremiah said, were not true, nor were they bound to happen. As long as Zedekiah listened to the prophet saying these things, he was persuaded and agreed that they spoke the truth and that it was to his advantage to believe them. But his friends corrupted him again and drew him away from the prophet's words toward what they themselves wished. Ezekiel, too, prophesied in Babylon the calamities that were going to befall the people, and wrote these things down and sent them to Jerusalem. Zedekiah, however, disbelieved their prophecies for the following reason. Everything else the two of them said agreed, that the city would be captured, and Zedekiah himself taken prisoner. But they disagreed on this point. Ezekiel said Zedekiah would not see Babylon, while Jeremiah told him that the king of Babylon would lead him there in chains. And because the two did not say the same thing, Zedekiah judged that even the points on which they seemed to agree were not true either. Although in fact everything came to pass for him just as the prophecies said, as we shall show at the appropriate point. Having maintained the alliance with the Babylonians for 8 years, he then broke faith with them and went over to the Egyptians, hoping with their help to overthrow the Babylonians, in alliance with whom that hope had arisen. When the king of Babylon learned of this, he marched against him, ravaged his land, took his strongholds, and came against the city of the Jerusalemites to besiege it. The Egyptian king, hearing that his ally Zedekiah was in this position, took a large force and came into Judea to lift the siege. The Babylonian withdrew from Jerusalem, met the Egyptians, joined battle with them, defeated them, put them to flight, and pursued them out of all Syria. But when the king of Babylon had withdrawn from Jerusalem, the false prophets deceived Zedekiah, telling him that the Babylonian would no longer make war on him and his people, and that those of his countrymen whom he had carried off from their homeland to Babylon would return, along with all the vessels of the temple, which the king had plundered from the shrine. But Jeremiah came forward and prophesied the opposite of this, and the truth, that they were acting wickedly and deceiving the king, that no benefit at all would come to them from the Egyptians, but that the Babylonian, having defeated the Egyptians, was about to march against Jerusalem, and would besiege it and destroy the people by famine, and would carry off as captives those who survived, and would plunder their property, and would carry away the wealth in the temple, and then burn it down and raze the city, and that we would be enslaved to him and his descendants for 70 years. Then the Persians and the Medes would put an end to our slavery under them, having overthrown the Babylonians, and from them we would be released to return to this land and rebuild the temple again and restore Jerusalem. When Jeremiah said these things, most people believed him, but the officials and the impious dismissed him as out of his mind. Once, when he happened to be going to his hometown, called Anathoth, 20 stadia from Jerusalem, he met on the road one of the officials, who seized and detained him, falsely accusing him of deserting to the Babylonians. Jeremiah said the man was bringing a false charge against him, and insisted he was simply walking to his hometown. But the man, not believing him, seized him and brought him to trial before the officials, who, after he endured every kind of abuse and torture, kept him under guard for punishment. For some time he continued to suffer unjustly in this way. In the 9th year of Zedekiah's reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, the king of Babylon marched a second time against Jerusalem, and having encamped before it, besieged it with the utmost determination for 18 months. Two of the greatest afflictions struck the besieged people of Jerusalem at the same time, famine and a devastating plague, both raging fiercely. While confined in prison, the prophet Jeremiah did not keep silent, but cried out and proclaimed, urging the people to open the gates and receive the Babylonian. For by doing this, he said, they would be saved, household and all, but if not, they would perish. He foretold that whoever remained in the city would surely die, either consumed by famine or by the enemy's sword, but that whoever fled to the enemy would escape death. Even in the midst of these terrible circumstances, the officials who heard this did not believe him, but went to the king in anger to report it, accusing the prophet and demanding he be put to death as a madman who was breaking the people's spirit beforehand, and, through the discouraging pronouncements of a coward, undermining the readiness of the people to risk danger for him and for their homeland. The prophet, they said, was urging them to flee to the enemy, saying the city would be captured and everyone would perish. The king himself, out of decency and justice, was not personally provoked by this, but so as not to offend the officials by opposing their purpose at such a critical moment, he handed the prophet over to them to do with as they wished. When the king had granted them this, they went straight to the prison, took him, and lowered him into a pit full of mud, so that he might die his own particular death by suffocation. He was there, sunk in the mire up to his neck. But one of the king's household servants, a man held in honor and an Ethiopian by birth, reported the prophet's plight to the king, saying that his friends and officials had acted wrongly in sinking the prophet into the mud, and that they had thereby devised for him a death more bitter than execution by the sword. Hearing this, the king regretted having handed the prophet over to the officials, and ordered the Ethiopian to take 30 of the royal guard along with ropes and everything useful for saving the prophet, and to draw Jeremiah up without delay. The Ethiopian, taking the men assigned to him, pulled the prophet out of the mud and released him unguarded. The king then summoned him secretly and asked what he could tell him from God, and what he could reveal concerning the present situation. Jeremiah said he did have something to say, but that if he spoke it, he would not be believed, nor would his advice be heeded. "Instead, as though I had done some great wrong, your friends have resolved to destroy me," he said. "And where now are those who told you the Babylonian would never march against us again and deceived you? I am afraid now to tell the truth, lest you condemn me to death." When the king swore an oath to him that he would neither kill him himself nor hand him over to the officials, Jeremiah, taking courage from the pledge given him, advised him to surrender the city to the Babylonians. For God, he said, was prophesying this to him through himself. If indeed the king wished to be saved and escape the danger now threatening him, so that neither the city would fall to the ground nor the temple be burned. For its burning would be the cause of these calamities for the citizens and for himself and his household, of the disaster. Hearing this, the king said he himself wished to do as Jeremiah advised, and agreed that it would be to his advantage to do so, but that he feared the countrymen who had deserted to the Babylonians, lest he be slandered by them to the king and punished. The prophet reassured him, telling him his fear was groundless, for no harm would come to him at the hands of the Babylonians if he surrendered, neither to himself nor to his children nor his wives, and the temple too would remain unharmed. Having said this, Jeremiah was released by the king, who instructed him to reveal to none of the citizens, nor even to the officials, should they learn he had been summoned by the king and ask what he had said when called before him, anything of what had been decided between them, but to claim to them, if pressed, that he had merely begged Zedekiah must not be kept in chains or in prison. This is what he said to the men who had come to the prophet, asking what he had gone to the king to plead for. So much for that exchange. As for the siege of Jerusalem, the Babylonian pressed it with the utmost intensity and energy. He built great siege towers, and from them kept the men stationed on the walls at bay, and he raised earthworks all around the circuit of the city equal in height to the walls themselves. The people inside bore the siege with courage and resolve. They were worn down neither by famine nor by the plague that ravaged them. But even while these afflictions drove them within, they kept their spirits strong for the fight, undaunted by the enemy's stratagems and machines, countering everything the Babylonians devised with counter-devices of their own. So that the whole contest, for both the Babylonians and the people of Jerusalem, turned on sharpness of wit and understanding, the one side supposing they could destroy the city more readily by this means, the other placing their hope of survival in nothing but never tiring, never giving up, and matching invention with invention until the enemy's engines were shown to be useless. They held out like this for 18 months, until they were finally worn down by famine and by the missiles the enemy hurled at them from the towers. The city was taken in the 11th year of Zedekiah's reign, on the 9th day of the 4th month. It was the generals of the Babylonians, to whom Nebuchadnezzar had entrusted the siege, who took it. He himself was residing in the city of Arabatha at the time. As for the names of the generals, in case anyone wishes to know who it was that stormed and subdued Jerusalem, they were Regalceros, Aramantos, Semigeros, Nabasaris, and Acharampsaris. When the city was taken, around the middle of the night, and the enemy generals had entered the temple, King Zedekiah learned of it, and, taking his wives and children, his officers and his friends, fled with them from the city through the strong ravine and out into the desert. But some deserters told the Babylonians of this, and at daybreak they set out in pursuit, and overtaking him not far from Jericho, surrounded him. The friends and officers who had fled with Zedekiah, when they saw the enemy close at hand, abandoned him and scattered, each man going his own way and looking to save himself. Zedekiah, left behind with only a few companions, was taken alive by the enemy, and together with his children and wives was brought before the king. When he was brought into his presence, Nebuchadnezzar began to call him impious and a breaker of oaths, and forgetful of the earlier pledges he had made to preserve his rule for him. He reproached him too for his ingratitude, for it was Nebuchadnezzar himself who had taken the kingdom from Jehoiakim and given it to him, and yet he had used the power granted him against the very man who had granted it. "But God is great," he said, "who has hated your conduct and put you in our hands." Having spoken these words to Zedekiah, he ordered his sons and his friends killed at once, before Zedekiah's own eyes and those of the other captives. Then he had Zedekiah's eyes put out, bound him, and led him away to Babylon. And this is exactly what Jeremiah and Ezekiel had prophesied would happen to him, that he would be seized and brought before the Babylonian, that he would speak with him face to face, and that his eyes would see the eyes of the other. This much Jeremiah had foretold. But once blinded and led to Babylon, Zedekiah did not see that city, just as Ezekiel had foretold. We have now related events sufficient to reveal the nature of God to those who do not know it, that it is manifold and versatile, and meets each occasion in its due season, foretelling what must come to pass, while the ignorance and unbelief of men, by which they are prevented from foreseeing anything that is to happen, leaves them unguarded and exposed to disaster, so that there is no way for them to escape the trial that comes from it. So ended the lives of those kings descended from the house of David, 21 in all down to the last king, who reigned altogether 514 years, 6 months, and 10 days, of which the first of them, Saul, who was not of that same tribe, held the throne for 20 years. The Babylonians sent his general Nebuzaradan to Jerusalem to plunder the temple, ordering him at the same time to burn it down along with the palace, to raze the city to the ground, and to remove the people to Babylonia. Nebuzaradan, arriving at Jerusalem in the 11th year of Zedekiah's reign, plundered the temple and carried off the vessels of God, gold, and silver, including the great laver that Solomon had dedicated, and further the bronze pillars and their capitals, the golden tables, and the lampstands. Having removed all this, he set fire to the temple on the new moon of the 5th month, in the 11th year of Zedekiah's reign and the 18th of Nebuchadnezzar's. He also burned the palace and razed the city. The temple was burned 470 years, 6 months, and 10 days after it had been built. From the exodus of the people out of Egypt to that time was 1,062 years, 6 months, and 10 days. From the flood down to the destruction of the temple, the whole span was 1,957 years, 6 months, and 10 days. And from the birth of Adam to the events surrounding the temple, the years amount to 4,513, 6 months, and 10 days. Such, then, is the sum of these years. And as for what happened at each of these occurrences, we have set it out in detail. The general of the Babylonian king, after razing Jerusalem and removing the people, took captive the high priest Seraiah, the priest next in rank after him, Zephaniah, the officers who guarded the temple, 3 in number, the eunuch in command of the soldiers, 7 of Zedekiah's friends, his scribe, and 60 other officers. All these, together with the vessels he had plundered, he brought to the king at Riblah, a city of Syria. The king ordered the high priest and the officers beheaded there, but he himself led all the other captives, together with Zedekiah, in chains to Babylon, and also Jehozadak the high priest, son of the high priest Seraiah, whom the Babylonian had put to death at the city of Riblah in Syria, as we have already related. Now that we have gone through the line of the kings and shown who they were and how long they reigned, I have thought it necessary also to give the names of the high priests and to say who they were, those who held the high priesthood alongside the kings. Zadok then was the first high priest of the temple that Solomon built. After him, his son Ahimaaz succeeded to the honor, and after Ahimaaz, Azariah, after him Joram, after Joram Ioz, after him Exiramos, after Exiramos Phidias, after Phidias Sudias, after Sudias Yolos, after him Jotham, after Jotham Uriah, after Uriah Neriah, after Neriah Odias, after him Salamos, after Salamos Elkiah, after Elkiah Azeros, and after him Jehozadak, who was carried captive to Babylon. All these succeeded to the high priesthood, son after father. When the king arrived in Babylon, he kept Zedekiah in prison until his death, and after burying him in royal fashion, he dedicated the vessels plundered from the temple of Jerusalem to his own gods, settled the people in the land of Babylonia, and released the high priest from his chains. The general Nebuzaradan, having taken the people of the Hebrews captive, left behind there the poor and those who had deserted, and appointed as their governor Jedaliah, son of Ahikam, a man of noble birth, moderate, and just. He charged them to work the land and pay a fixed tribute to the king. He also took the prophet Jeremiah out of prison and urged him to come with him to Babylon, for the king had ordered that everything be furnished him there. But if he did not wish this, he was to say where he had decided to remain, so that word of it could be sent to the king. The prophet was unwilling either to follow him or to remain anywhere else. He was content to live out his life among the ruins of his homeland and its wretched remnants. Learning of his choice, the general instructed Jedaliah, whom he had left behind, to take every care of him at once and to supply him with whatever he needed. And after presenting him with costly gifts, he released him. Jeremiah remained behind at Dana, a town in the district called Masphatha, having asked Nebuzaradan to release along with him his disciple Baruch, son of Neriah, who came from a very distinguished family and had been unusually well-educated in his native tongue. Having settled these matters, Nebuzaradan set out for Babylon. Meanwhile, those who had fled Jerusalem during the siege and scattered through the countryside, on hearing that the Babylonians had withdrawn and had left some remnants behind in the land of the people of Jerusalem, along with those who would work it, gathered from every quarter and came to Jedaliah at Mizpah. Among them, the leaders were Johanan son of Kareah, Sariah, and Jazaniah, along with others besides. And there was among them a certain Ishmael, of the royal family, a wicked and thoroughly treacherous man, who during the siege of Jerusalem had fled to Bales, king of the Ammonites, and had spent that time with him. Jedaliah persuaded these men, once they had come to him, to remain at once without any fear of the Babylonians, for if they worked the land, he told them, they would suffer no harm. He swore to this again and again, telling them to regard him as their protector, so that if anyone troubled them, they would find him ready to act on their behalf. He advised them to settle, each sending for his own household in whatever town he wished, to rebuild the ruins and dwell there. He told them to prepare, while there was still time, grain, wine, and oil, so that they would have provisions through the winter. Having said this to them, he sent them off through the country to whatever place each wished to go. When word spread among the nations around Judea that Jedaliah had welcomed with kindness those who had come to him as fugitives, and had allowed them to settle and work the land on condition of paying tribute to the Babylonian, they too came flocking to Jedaliah and settled in the country. Observing the land and Jedaliah's kindness and generosity, Johanan and the officers with him came to love him greatly. But Bales, king of the Ammonites, they said, had sent Ishmael to kill him treacherously and in secret, so that he himself might rule over the Israelites, since he was of the royal line. They said they could save Jedaliah from this plot if he would allow them to kill Ishmael, since no one would know of it. For they said they feared that if Jedaliah were murdered by him, it would mean the utter ruin of what remained of the strength of the Israelites. But Jedaliah declared he did not believe them, that they were bringing such a charge against a man who had done nothing but good to him. It was not reasonable, he said, that a man in such dire straits, having failed to find what he needed nowhere else, should turn out to be so wicked and impious toward his own benefactor as to plot to kill the very man who had saved him from being plotted against by others, when no one else was scheming against him. Even so, he said, if this should prove true, it would be better for him to die at that man's hand than to destroy a man who had taken refuge with him, trusted him with his own safety, and placed himself in his keeping. So Johanan and the officers with him, unable to persuade Jedaliah, went away. 30 days later, Ishmael came to Jedaliah at the town of Mizpah with 10 men. Jedaliah received them at a lavish table with gifts of hospitality, and growing warm with drink, entertained Ishmael and his companions generously. But when Ishmael saw him in this state, sunk in insensibility and sleep from the wine, he sprang up with his 10 companions and cut down Jedaliah and all who were reclining with him at the banquet. After this slaughter, he went out by night and murdered all the Jews in the town, as well as the soldiers the Babylonians had left behind there. The next day, 80 men came from the countryside to Jedaliah bearing gifts, none of them knowing what had happened. Seeing them, Ishmael called them inside as if to see Jedaliah, and once they had entered, he shut the outer gate and slaughtered them, throwing their bodies into a deep pit so that they would not be found. Of these 80 men, those who had begged not to be killed until they had handed over what they had hidden in the fields, furniture, clothing, and grain, were spared. On hearing this, Ishmael spared these men. But the people who were in Mizpah, along with the women and children, he took captive, among them the daughters of King Zedekiah, whom Nebuzaradan, the Babylonian general, had left in Jedaliah's care. Having done all this, he made his way to the king of the Ammonites. When Johanan and the officers with him heard what Ishmael had done at Mizpah and of Jedaliah's death, they were outraged, and each taking his own armed men, they set out to make war on Ishmael and overtook him by the spring at Hebron. Those whom Ishmael had taken captive, on seeing Johanan and the officers, rejoiced, supposing help had come for them, and abandoning the man who had captured them, went over to Johanan. Ishmael, with eight men, fled to the king of the Ammonites. Johanan, taking those he had rescued from Ishmael's hands, along with the eunuchs, the women, and the children, arrived at a place called Mandra. He remained there that day, but they had resolved to set out from there for Egypt, fearing that the Babylonians would kill them if they stayed in the country, out of anger over the murder of Jedaliah, whom the Babylonians themselves had appointed governor. This was the situation at that time. While they were deliberating this course, Johanan son of Kareah and the officers who were with him came to the prophet Jeremiah and urged him to entreat God on their behalf, since they were at a loss what to do, and to show them his will. They swore that they would do whatever Jeremiah told them. When the prophet had promised to intercede for them with God, it happened that after 10 days God appeared to him and told him to make known to Johanan and the other officers and all the people that if they remained in that country, he would be present with them, would care for them, and would keep them safe from the Babylonians whom they feared. But if they went to Egypt, he would abandon them and in anger, would treat them just as they knew their kinsmen had been treated before. When the prophet reported these words of God to Johanan and the people, they did not believe that God was foretelling this to them. They claimed instead that he was commanding them, in obedience to that same command, to remain in the country, and that he was falsifying God's word only as a favor to his own disciple Baruch, persuading them to stay so that they might be destroyed by the Babylonians. So the people in Johanan disregarded the counsel that God had given them through the prophet, and set out for Egypt, taking with them both Jeremiah and Baruch. After they arrived there, God revealed to the prophet that the king of the Babylonians was about to march against the Egyptians, and ordered him to foretell to the people both the capture of Egypt and the fact that some of them the king would kill, while others he would take captive and lead away to Babylon. And this came to pass. For in the 5th year after the sack of Jerusalem, which was the 23rd year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar marched against Celesyria, seized it, and made war also on the Moabites and the Ammonites. Having subdued these nations, he invaded Egypt to conquer it, killed the king then reigning, set up another in his place, and took the Jews who were there captive once again and led them to Babylon. So the Hebrew people met with this end, having twice crossed the Euphrates as we have recorded. The people of the 10 tribes were driven out from Samaria by the Assyrians when Hoshea was their king, and afterward the 2 tribes were driven out by Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Babylonians and the Chaldeans, along with whoever had been left behind after Jerusalem was taken. Now Shalmaneser, having removed the Israelites, settled in their place the nation of the Chaldeans, who had previously lived in the interior of Persia and Media, but were then called Samaritans, having taken the name of the region into which they were resettled. The king of the Babylonians, however, having led the 2 tribes away, settled no nation in their country in their place. And for this reason all Judea, Jerusalem, and the temple remained deserted for 70 years. The whole span of time that had elapsed from the captivity of the Israelites to the removal of the 2 tribes came to 130 years, 6 months and 10 days. Now Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Babylonians, took the noblest of the Jewish children and the kinsmen of Zedekiah their king, who were conspicuous both for the vigor of their bodies and the beauty of their faces, and handed them over to tutors and to be cared for under them, making some of them eunuchs. He did the same with the children of the other nations he had conquered, choosing those taken in the prime of life. He supplied them food from his own table for their diet, and had them educated both in the customs of the country and in Chaldean letters, for they were capable enough in the learning he ordered them to pursue. Among these were four of the family of Zedekiah, handsome and of good natural gifts, one of whom was called Daniel, another Ananias, another Misael, and the fourth Azarias. The Babylonian gave them new names and ordered them to use these instead. Daniel he called Baltasar, Ananias Sedrach, Misael Misach, and Azarias Abidnego. The king, because of their extraordinary natural ability and their diligence in study and the progress they made in wisdom, held them in honor and continued to love them. Daniel resolved, together with his kinsmen, to discipline himself and to abstain from the food that came from the king's table, and indeed from everything that had life in it. He went to Ashings, the eunuch entrusted with their care, and asked him to take for himself what was regularly sent to them from the king, and instead to provide them with pulse and dates for their food, and whatever else he wished among things without life. For this was the diet toward which they were inclined, and they had no regard for the other. Ashings said he was ready to serve their purpose, but was afraid that if they became visibly thin and their features changed, it would become obvious to the king. For their bodies and complexions would necessarily change along with their diet, and since the other children would appear healthy by comparison, he himself might be exposed as responsible, and so face danger and punishment. Being thus apprehensive, Ashings was persuaded by them to provide this food for 10 days as a trial. And if their bodily condition did not change, he was to continue with the same diet, since it would clearly do them no further harm, but if he saw them grow thinner and worse off than the others, he was to return them to their former diet. When it turned out that not only did this food do them no harm at all, but that they became better nourished and larger in body than the others, so that those fed on royal provision seemed the more deficient, while Daniel's companions seemed to be living amid abundance and every luxury. From that time on, Ashings safely took for himself what the king daily sent to the children in the customary way, and supplied them instead with the food already mentioned. Because of this, their souls became pure and keen for learning, and their bodies more vigorous for hard exertion, since they were not weighed down by the burden of rich and varied food, nor were their minds made soft by the same cause. And so they readily mastered the whole range of learning that existed among the Hebrews and the Chaldeans. Daniel, above all, being by now well versed in wisdom, applied himself earnestly to the interpretation of dreams, and God made himself manifest to him. In the second year after the sack of Egypt, King Nebuchadnezzar saw a marvelous dream, the meaning of which God himself had revealed to him in his sleep. But on rising from his bed, he forgot it. He summoned the Chaldeans, the magicians, and the diviners, told them he had seen a dream, and explaining that the memory of what he had seen had escaped him, ordered them to tell him what the dream was and what it signified. When they said it was impossible for men to discover this, but that if he would describe the vision of the dream to them, they promised to explain its meaning, he threatened them with death if they did not tell him the dream itself, and ordered that all of them be put to death, since they had admitted they were unable to do what he demanded. When Daniel heard that the king had ordered all the wise men to be killed, and that he himself, along with his kinsmen, was in danger among them, he went to Arioch, who had been entrusted with command over the king's bodyguard. He asked to learn from him the reason why the king had ordered all the wise men, Chaldeans, and magicians to be put to death, and on learning about the dream, and that they had provoked the king by admitting that, though commanded to reveal it, they were unable to do so because he had forgotten it, he urged Arioch to go into the king and ask for a single night's delay for the magicians, so as to postpone their execution, for he hoped that by praying to God during that night he would come to know the dream. Arioch reported this to the king, that Daniel requested this favor, and the king ordered that the execution of the magicians be postponed until he learned Daniel's answer. The young man, withdrawing with his kinsmen to his own quarters, spent the whole night imploring God to reveal to him the dream, and thereby to save also the magicians and Chaldeans who were bound to perish along with them, by disclosing to the king the vision he had seen in his sleep the night before, which he had forgotten, and making it plain to him, and so to rescue them from the king's anger. God, taking pity both on those in danger and admiring Daniel's wisdom, made both the dream and its interpretation known to him, so that he might also inform the king of what it signified. When Daniel learned this from God, He rose up filled with joy, and telling his brothers, he lifted the spirits of those who had already given up hope of living and had resigned themselves to death, and awakened in them hope for their lives. And having given thanks to God, who had taken pity on them together, when day came he went to Arioch and asked to be brought before the king, saying that he wished to reveal to him the dream he said he had seen the night before. Brought in before the king, Daniel first asked that the king not think him wiser than the other Chaldeans and magicians, simply because, when none of them had been able to discover the dream, he was about to tell it. For this did not come about through his own skill, nor because he had labored over the matter more diligently than they, but because God, taking pity on us who were in danger of death, had made both the dream and its interpretation clear in answer to my prayer on behalf of my own life and that of my countrymen. For I grieved no less than you, who had been condemned by you to die, over your own reputation, that you had ordered men so noble and good to be put to death so unjustly, men to whom you had demanded nothing that lay within human wisdom, but had required of them what belonged to God alone.